Good evening and welcome back. I'd like to introduce you to a man who is one of my best friends in the whole world, William Potter. Your brochure tells you a little bit about his skill and abilities with respect to his leadership and as president of the Williamsburg Civil War Roundtable, someone who served as a reenactor of the 1st Texas Infantry, a consultant for the Antietam National Battlefield, an elder in the Presbyterian Church of America, and someone who is active in lecturing on the war, the chaplaincy, and revivals. I should also tell you that Bill is the proud father of 8 children, whose names include Dabney, Davis, Electa, Jackson, Bell, Brandon, Lydia, and Claire. So, true to his beliefs, his children are aptly and appropriately named. His excellent and outstanding helpmeet, Leslie, is here as well, a very good friend of my wife, whose name is Belle. And the Potter family has been a tremendous blessing. When I was a student at the College of William and Mary, they took us into their home and under their wing and put up with us through many interesting events. I was just remembering as I was sitting next to Bill that it wasn't too long ago when we were worshiping at a PCA church in Williamsburg, Virginia, and I was with Bill and the other elders at this particular church. One of the wives of one of the elders asked me a question. She asked me if I could help her daughter get into the military by giving a recommendation to a congressman. And I said, well, yes, ma'am, I could, but I won't do it. At which point, she became quite irate and uncomfortable. And Bill has always stood by my side, put up with me, defended me, and he's been such a faithful friend. Bill is a relative of a Confederate soldier who fought with the Minden, Louisiana Rangers. He's homeschooled his 8 children. Today, he is the proud wearer of a pin of the state of Georgia, which, of course, has the battle flag of it, and he's wearing it as a reminder to all of us in the aftermath of the Olympics, in which the Georgia battle flag was barred from the Olympics because of the politically correct positions held there. One of the things that impressed me most about Bill when I first met him was the courageous stand that he was willing to take as a student, as a PhD candidate at the College of William and Mary, and here's a man who literally has suffered persecution and loss because of his stand for Christ and for the Confederacy. I'm proud to introduce to you my very good friend and accomplished Civil War scholar and historian, Mr. William Potter.
Thank you for that kind introduction. I'd like to thank Pastor Sprinkle for my promotion to the lofty status of Dr. Potter. My resume actually reads PhD ABD, which means all but dissertation. But that fits perfectly into a theory that I have. It's the Potter theory of retroactive promotion. It works this way. The more of your contemporaries that you outlive, the higher your rank you achieved in your past. And the perfect illustration of this is my great-grandfather, who fought in the war of unmitigated Yankee aggression a few years ago. He lived to be 96 years old, and he achieved the actual rank of sergeant in 4 years of war. By 1900, though, he was called Captain Brandon. By 1920, he was Colonel Brandon. By 1930, he was General Brandon. Had he lived to 1940, there would have been but a handful who could have gainsaid his status as Commander-in-Chief of the Army. Now, I did my PhD program about 15 years ago, and having now been promoted to full PhD, if I live another 20 years, I will have been the President of William & Mary. And if I outlive everybody here, I will probably be the founder of that august institution. Perhaps I will be Thomas Jefferson himself. I don't know. But in any case, you can make that correction on your brochure there by adding ABD. Also, I was going to do this at the end of my talk, but I'm sure I'll forget. I have put together just a brief suggested bibliography of books concerning the Confederate chaplaincy and considering the effect of the Christian ministry in the Confederate armies. And there are 10 copies of it up here, and if they disappear, we'll make more. because they will be applicable for all three lectures this week. It's broken down into general books on the Confederate chaplaincy, of which most of them are not in print at this present time, but of course William W. Bennett's A Narrative of the Great Revival is in print, available from an obscure press in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Also listed on here is a PhD dissertation, which I do have in hardcover, but it's never been published. And it's the finest thing ever written on the Confederate chaplaincy. It's entitled For Now and Forever, The Chaplains of the Confederate States Army. PhD dissertation. It was done at UCLA in 1964. And it's not available. You can get it from University Microfilms in Michigan. But it's a wonderful book. And then, of course, J. William Jones, Christ in the Camp, or Religion in Lee's Army, also available from Sprinkle Publications. And then the three standard works on the Confederate chaplaincy, none of which are at all comprehensive, but actually do cover the basics of the Confederate chaplaincy by Herman Norton, Charles Pitts, and Sidney Romero, which are on there. And then I also included some biographies and reminiscences of chaplains that exist, and some of them are available. Most of them are not. They are on the antiquarian or secondary book market. And also denominational reference works, which you may not be as interested in. And then some, finally, some Christian soldier reminiscences of note. There were many, many wonderful Christian men who actually survived the war and kept their diaries and wrote their reminiscences. And some of these men recorded information about their chaplains, about the preaching in the army, about the great revivals. And I've just suggested a handful of things here, particularly some that are still in print, and are one of which was just recently published. And I noticed on the book table back there, there's even a copy of David Holt, a Mississippi rebel in the Army of Northern Virginia. That is a wonderful regimental reminiscence by a member of the 16th Mississippi. And he was a young 17-year-old soldier from Mississippi. He was about 5 foot tall, and he survived the war and became a great preacher. And this reminiscence was published this year by LSU Press, and it's gory. I mean, it's got some great battle tales, but there's a great deal of spiritual victory contained in the pages of that reminiscence. It's a little known, and I saw a copy back there, and it's worth having. So there are a number of things. So if you're interested in further pursuing the study of the influence of God in the Army of Northern Virginia, and in all the Confederate armies, really, you might want to consult this. There are many more books than this. This is just kind of a suggested reading list for those who have interest. Of the thousands of books that have been written on the war for Southern independence, there are very few which mention the Confederate chaplaincy at all. And even fewer still are the historians who try to analyze the vital role these men of God had and these men of God played in sustaining the cause, in leading men to Christ, and in performing many valuable ministries in the armies. There are hundreds of memoirs, reminiscences, and letters that refer to what Chaplain W.W. Bennett referred to as the Great Revival in the Confederate armies, which were largely led and promoted by the chaplains. Unregenerate historians of the war are baffled by the sincerity of the converts and the spiritual renewal of believers. And when they think of it at all, they try to explain it away with sociological theories, what Doug called earlier psychobabble, which is what it is. And that's how they explain conversion and the Christian faith, looking back at men in history. Only a true Christian knows the reality of the new birth and can appreciate, really appreciate the work of God in history. And that's what history is all about. It's the work of God being worked out in what philosophers would call the secondary causal realm. But only Christians can truly understand the work of God in that way. We owe a great debt of gratitude to Pastor Sprinkle for providing this opportunity to bring to light the true ministry of the Confederate chaplaincy and the widespread outpouring of the Holy Spirit in those armies during the war. Many thousands of men in gray came to know Christ as their Savior, and many thousands more were renewed as believers. truly changed hearts and the sovereign grace of God in men's lives is not something we can quantify. And it's certainly of eternal consequence. And it's difficult to determine the impact for the culture and for life after the war. But I'm going to make a few comments about what I think the impact of the revivals and the impact of the ministry of chaplains was even in the post-war world. Chaplain J. William Jones of the 13th Virginia Infantry, and Dr. J. William Jones is the man I was going to do my PhD dissertation on originally. He does not have a biography. Unfortunately, his papers were all lost, but he left a couple billion words in print on all kinds of subjects, and he's the author of Christ in the Camp. And he started out as a chaplain in the 13th Virginia, and he was so successful as a minister of the gospel that he became a preacher to the whole army and a good friend of Robert E. Lee, especially after the war. But he said on one occasion, "Any history of that army which omits an account of the wonderful influences of religion upon it, which fails to tell how the courage, discipline, and morale of the whole was influenced by the humble piety and evangelical zeal of its officers and men, would be incomplete and unsatisfactory," which I'm afraid then describes almost everything written in general about the war. In the final paragraph of his summary of the military needs of the Confederacy, I read this just the other day in reading William Davis's book on the founding of the Confederacy, A Nation of Our Own, I believe is the title of it. Anyway, Secretary of War Leroy P. Walker, in his final report in Montgomery, Alabama, to Jefferson Davis, the new president, just before the government moved from Montgomery to Richmond in April of 1861, he wrote his final report on the status of the Confederacy in April of 61, and he said, in the conclusion to his voluminous reports on munitions, troops, everything that was going on in the infrastructure of the new Confederate states, he wrote, "I cannot more appropriately conclude this report than by urging upon Congress the passage of a law empowering this department to appoint chaplains for the service. Military experience demonstrates the importance of religious habitudes to the morality, good order, and general discipline of an army in the camp or in the field. If we expect God to bless us in our struggle in defense of our rights, to terminate in all probability only after a protracted and bloody war, we must recognize Him in all our actions. There was ample precedence in American history for the appointment of godly men to pastor soldiers in peace and war, and now especially those rambunctious Celtic teenagers bent on whipping Abraham Lincoln's minions. No less a figure than George Washington told the national legislature in the 1700s that he wanted his men to attend religious services, quote, if only to restrain profanity and drunkenness. The U.S. Congress responded by authorizing one chaplain per brigade with pay equal to that of a colonel. With the coming of the war in 1861, hundreds of pastors entered the ranks of the Confederate armies as privates, officers, and chaplains. Approximately 1,200 men served as chaplains over the course of the war. Certain that God willed their defense of liberty, hearth, and altar, the churches proclaimed their willingness to do everything possible to repel the invaders. One historian commenting on the impact of the church in the war wrote that, and I quote, and this is from a historian who I don't believe is a professing Christian necessarily, but he wrote, "As its greatest social institution, the church in the South constituted the major resource of the Confederacy in the building and maintenance of civilian morale. As no other group, Southern clergymen were responsible for a state of mind that made secession possible, and as no other group, they sustained the people in their long, costly war for Southern independence." Well, when the war came, prominent Southern preachers left no doubt as to what the issues that were most involved were as they spoke to their congregations. Benjamin Morgan Palmer, who was pastor of the Presbyterian Church in New Orleans, gave a speech to the citizens of New Orleans, a speech that one who heard it said that sermon in New Orleans was worth 10,000 men to the army because they flocked to the colors. But in that address, he said, "In this struggle, we defend the cause of God and religion." The Episcopal Bishop Stephen Elliott of Savannah, Georgia, said, to his congregation, we are fighting for great principles which must not be compromised. We are fighting to drive away the infidel, rationalistic principles that are sweeping over the land. And then finally, the prince of theologians of the Southern Presbyterian Church, Robert Louis Dabney accepted, was James Henley Thornwell. And Thornwell of South Carolina was a stalwart in supporting the cause and rallying students, especially, to the army. And he said, and I think rightly so and perceptively so, the following: "The parties of this conflict are not merely abolitionists and slaveholders. They are atheists, socialists, communists, red Republicans, Jacobins on one side," I won't tell you which side, "and the friends of order and regulated freedom on the other. In one word, the world is the battleground, Christianity and atheism the combatants, and the progress of humanity the stake." Didn't mince words, like Dabney. Said what he thought, meant what he said. Even the great Robert Louis Dabney, prior to secession, was a voice of moderation. Dabney did not think secession was a good idea. And he worked within the Presbyterian Church in Virginia to keep the state from seceding. But like many other pastors across the South who opposed secession initially, once their state left the Union, there was no question. And their loyalty to their state, to their family, to their God, was so far more paramount than the Union, which had been made, in their way of thinking, a rope of sand by the election of Abraham Lincoln. Once the die was cast, there was no question where their loyalties lay. A few northern-born southern pastors, or pastors in southern churches, left the South. I've only been able to find a handful, but they did go north. And conversely, a number of southern men who were in northern pulpits left because their congregations made it intolerable on both sides for them to remain on the fence or not supporting their respective causes. And so a number of southern men came south too, a few. A number of pastors served in the ranks. In fact, many, many pastors served in the ranks. There was a Georgia regiment that was said to have 8 pastors in the ranks. And they said they had more Baptists in that regiment than they had people. And many other pastors went and served as officers, as men in the ranks. We know of William Nelson Pendleton of Virginia, who commanded the 2nd Corps Artillery in the Army of Northern Virginia. Bishop Polk in the Army of Tennessee. They were high churchmen, but also West Point men. And they served as high officers, and there were others, many other pastors of middling rank. And we'll save them for another conference, because there are many, and they left some really fabulous records of their service for Christ and their service for their country. There were basically, though, 4 types of ministerial laborers in the army. There were, first of all, and foremost, chaplains. But there were also a goodly number of missionaries to the army. These were men who had the freedom to go to and fro throughout the army and preach the gospel whenever the opportunity afforded to whomever would listen. And every Protestant denomination had missionaries in the army. Several of them became extremely prominent, and their names crop up time and time again in the diaries, letters, and reminiscences. There were also evangelists, and these men were typically pastors who were perhaps a little older and couldn't sustain the rigors of campaigning. But for those of you who have served in the armed forces, and if you've ever served in a war, you realize that 99% of your time is spent in camp and doing stuff other than going out and getting killed. So only, 1 to 5% of a soldier's time has anything to do, really, with combat. So you have these hundreds of thousands of idle men in the camps. And it was a ripe opportunity for evangelists, especially around the cities of the Confederacy, to go out to the camps and just to preach when opportunity afforded. And there were some wonderful men who did that just as evangelists. And then the fourth type, which most people are not very familiar with, but the fourth type of ministerial laborer in the Confederate armies was a man called a coal porter. Coal porters were the guys who went out and distributed literature. And the Army was voracious for acquiring good, solid Christian literature. And so there were men who dedicated their lives to getting tracts and Bibles and religious magazines, denominational magazines, anything that they could get their hands on that preached the gospel. And also, at the same time, fought against the various vices that were rampant in the army and get those into the hands of the soldiers. And they did so by the hundreds of thousands of pieces of literature. And as the war went on, it became harder and harder for them because of the scarcity of paper. And the denominational magazines got shorter and shorter. And at one point, well, I'm going to talk about them tomorrow night. So, what manner of men were these pastors in gray? Well, if you read the standard works on the Confederate chaplaincy, you'll find that each book on the Confederate chaplaincy actually deals with all the chaplains in all the armies in a very general fashion. And what I would like to do this evening is maybe focus fairly intently on the Virginia state chaplaincy, not by way of slighting chaplains from the other states. Good men served in the Confederate chaplaincy from every state in the Confederacy. But I want to hone in, it's easier, it brings it a little more to home if we focus in on one state, and we can perhaps get a better picture of what the whole was like by looking at, maybe just looking at a part. And so I'd like to focus on Virginia. Well, what did these Virginia chaplains, as they were preparing for war, what kind of men were they? What did they tell their congregations? What do you say? When your country's at war, invasion is imminent, you're standing in the pulpit, and you believe that your duty is to go with the men of the congregation who are going off to defend their hearth and homes. Reverend John H. Bocock, soon to become chaplain of the 7th Virginia Infantry, suggested to his parishioners after Lincoln's call for troops that yellow fever in the course of the summer would be worth 70,000 to us. He made the remark at Bridge Street Presbyterian Church in Georgetown, Maryland, and his removal south was hastened by the authorities. If you can imagine Pastor Sprinkle getting up in front of his congregation and saying, let's have a good yellow fever season this year along the Potomac. There won't be near as many Yankees to come down here. That's basically what he did. Pastor Bocock later left the chaplaincy position, and he ended up as the superintendent of the manufacture of munitions in Richmond. The chaplain of the 19th Virginia, Philip Slaughter, who was a good chaplain, produced a tract for distribution in the army in which he argued that only legitimate rulers must be obeyed, but when government is a terror to good works, the people have a right to rebel. He said the Union had become an idol and Lincoln a high priest. There was no room for passive obedience. Some Virginia chaplains and pastors were opponents of slavery. Men like John C. Granberry, who after the war is going to become one of the most prominent Episcopalian, evangelical Episcopalian bishops in the United States. And there were a number of Southern clergy who did not like slavery and were opposed to it. We'd not say they were abolitionists, but they did not like the system. But even men like that, like John Granberry, supported Virginia's break with the Union and served to his utmost ability in the Confederate ranks. He was a Methodist chaplain at the University of Virginia when the war started in 1861. He supported secession on, quote, constitutional grounds and joined the 11th Virginia. The chaplain in the 7th Virginia Cavalry, quote, made an excellent prayer for his country in front of his new regiment and concluded the address by saying, O Lord, thou knowest, I mean the Southern Confederacy. The Reverend Carson went on to become a popular member of the regimental staff. Now, these men came from various backgrounds, various educational and experiential backgrounds. There were the old school Presbyterians, almost all of whom had been educated at either Princeton or Hampton-Sydney Union Seminary. Hampton-Sydney itself counted 17 former students in the chaplaincy, 13 of them in Virginia units. And, of course, two of their alumni were nationally known figures, Robert Louis Dabney and Moses Drury Hoag. The Reverend Dabney was professor of theology at the seminary, and Moses Hoag was a pastor of the largest Presbyterian church in Richmond. Abner C. Hopkins, also an alumnus of Union Seminary, left his pastorate in Martinsburg and joined the 2nd Virginia many of whom were his own parishioners. L.C. Vass and Beverly Tucker Lacey were Virginian graduates of Princeton, and Thomas W. Gilmer, a graduate of both University of Virginia Law School and Union Seminary. I would find him highly suspect if those were his credentials today. But in that day, that was okay. But he had just obtained his license to preach in West Hanover Presbytery, and when duty called, he became the chaplain of the 2nd Corps Artillery. All of those Presbyterians and all of the Episcopalian chaplains were college and seminary graduates, as were many of the Baptist pastors. Not all the Methodists were, though. And their training came in a variety of different ways. W.J. Willis obtained an undergraduate degree from a northern college and a law degree from UVA. And the adventurous Willis had emigrated to California in the gold rush. He had made his fortune as a lawyer and a judge there before returning to his native state, and became a pastor in 1861, just in time to become a chaplain. He was a 24-year-old lawyer. He was pastor of Clay Street Chapel in Richmond. Another Baptist, James Allerson Broadus, M.A., University of Virginia, was a faculty member there at his alma mater and already a noted author, and he became a noted Virginia chaplain. Methodist circuit riding preachers, whose hours on horseback and braving inclement weather were especially suited for army life. Chaplain Thomas Conrad, for instance, quote, grew up on a horse and joined the 3rd Cavalry. His stated clerical mission that he said to his congregation and then to his regiment is bayonets and bullets for the invaders, Bibles and blessings for the people. The exact number of men per denomination which served in Virginia units or in Virginia hospitals, I might add that there was a tremendous ministry of the chaplains in the hospitals. There were, at any given time, there were 100,000 men, wounded men in hospitals across the state of Virginia. And local pastors spent a lot of time in those hospitals, as did chaplains who were assigned to those posts. Based on roughly 216 Virginia chaplains, I've been able to determine the kind of the denominational commitments of various ones. The Methodist Episcopal Church's Virginia Conference contained 178 churches in the state in 1860. But most of them had no full-time pastor, and they received the ministries of the circuit riders. At least 57 Virginia Methodist ministers filled chaplaincy positions at one time or another in Virginia. At the 1863 session meeting in Richmond, they reported 22 chaplains and 9 preachers in the ranks at that time. They also sent, starting in 1863, the Methodists began sending evangelists too, and we'll be getting into why that was on Thursday evening. The Presbyterian churches across the South had 130 ministers in the army, more than one-fourth of the total number of all the pastors in the denomination. The Presbyterian commitment to the Confederacy was enormous, and as I said, over a quarter of the pastors served in the war, and some of the very very best and prolific preachers in the army came from that denomination. At least 32 of the Presbyterian clerics in the army were in Virginia regiments and hospitals, as well as evangelists like 70-year-old J.C. Riles, who saw the Holy Spirit poured out when he was preaching. So he just kept on preaching. All through 1863 and 1864, wherever the army was in Virginia, J.C. Riles wasn't far away. J.C. Stiles, rather. And he was said by one soldier to be worth more than a brigade of wicked men. And the chaplain to the Confederate Congress, William J. Hoag, a highly respected man. And there was much we could say about him. The Virginia Baptists sent at least 26 preachers to Virginia regiments, and throughout the course of the war, continued through their denominational press, especially to urge men to enter the chaplaincy. There was some resistance among Baptists, having a rather independent mind on certain things, a certain resistance to the idea of the chaplaincy. I run across a number of Baptist ministers who said that to have state-supported chaplains was a mixture of church and state, and they ought not to do it. However, they poured into the ranks and the officer corps, and also as evangelists. So there were the ones who felt it was all right to be chaplains became chaplains, and the rest came and ministered anyway, wherever they found a good excuse to be there. And so they assisted the chaplains they didn't believe in the chaplaincy, sometimes they would come along and help the chaplains. The Episcopal Diocese of Virginia responded to the call by sending 24 men to the chaplaincy. The diocese also provided their chaplains with literature for distribution to the troops and especially irked their northern brethren by rewriting the Book of Common Prayer to include specific petitions for the blessings of the new government. The smallest Protestant representation in the Virginia regiments were Lutherans. There was only two Lutheran pastors, both from Shenandoah Valley, I might add. The 10th Virginia and the 29th Virginia had Lutherans. And also overwhelmingly outnumbered were the Roman Catholic chaplains. There were two Virginia chaplains, two padres. They were numerous in Tennessee regiments and numerous in Louisiana regiments, but in Virginia there were only two Roman Catholic chaplains. The eventual total number of chaplains from Virginia exceeds 200, but by the end of the first year of the war, quote, no denomination, with the possible exception of the Baptists, had yet formulated an official policy to recruit and commission chaplains through the periodicals, although the periodicals were urging that action. The first army clerics acted on their own initiative, and some unqualified and incompetent men filled the office. And these men typically were weeded out fairly quickly. The Southern men didn't waste much time on men of the cloth who were either incompetent or cowardly. And a few men got into the ranks that were both, and they were gone fast. By 1863, a man was holding a chaplaincy position. He was a man who was respected and had earned his position, and I'll talk about how they did that a little bit later. General D.H. Hill, who was a Presbyterian elder and formerly of one of their big Presbyterian colleges in the South, Davidson, commanding a brigade in Lee's army, wrote to a prominent Virginia minister in 1862 that his regimental chaplains, quote, are, as a general thing, as trifling as the regimental surgeons, which is the strongest enunciation I can use. During the course of 1862, however, the Presbyterians, Methodists, Episcopalians followed the Baptists by promoting the chaplaincy in their official publications. Although many Virginia pastors responded to the needs of the army, the demand for chaplains always exceeded the supply, and men of the caliber of Stonewall Jackson, who was a Presbyterian deacon from Lexington, urged through the denominational press and through the newspapers as well, the Richmond newspapers, urged pastors to get into chaplaincy positions. He wanted a chaplain in every single one of his regiments. And he didn't care if it was Presbyterian or not. He wanted evangelical, God-fearing men preaching the gospel to his troops. Some units, like the 20th Virginia and the 5th Virginia Cavalry, never did have a chaplain throughout the war, which does not mean they didn't hear the gospel because of the coming of the evangelists and others. A very few regiments probably didn't even need a chaplain. The Rockbridge Artillery, for instance, contained 19 theological students. In another case, every officer in the Liberty Hall Volunteers from Washington College, Washington and Lee, Company I of the 4th Virginia, were professing Christians. And every single officer, and more than half the rank and file belonged to some evangelical church, and about one-fourth were candidates for the ministry. So they didn't need a chaplain in that regiment because they had a bunch of really well-educated and respected men preaching the gospel. According to Frank Hieronymus, who wrote that PhD dissertation, the average Confederate chaplain served from 15 to 18 months, with the minimum being 3 months and the maximum, of course, a full 4 years. The peak number of Army ministers at any one time who had formal rank and service in the Army as a chaplain were somewhere between 80 and 90 in January of 1864. Now, remember, they had about 180 regiments in the Army of Northern Virginia. So there were always about half of the regiments with no regular ministry, but from the evangelists and missionaries. General Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, D.H. Hill, John B. Gordon, and other generals continue to urge the churches. And in fact, Stonewall Jackson, in writing to the Southern Presbyterian General Assembly, expressed his concern this way. He said, a bad selection of a chaplain may prove a curse instead of a blessing. If the few prominent ministers thus connected with each army would cordially cooperate, I believe that glorious fruits could be the result. Denominational distinction should be kept out of view. His congregation is his regiment, and it is composed of various denominations. I would like to see no questions asked in the Army of what denomination a chaplain belongs to. But let the question be, does he preach the gospel? The neglect of the spiritual interests of the Army may be seen from the fact that not one half of the regiments have chaplains. And Jackson was right. And when the Great Revival came, denominational distinctions were forgotten. It was a cooperative effort in the best biblical sense of cooperative effort in preaching the gospel. It was wonderful. It's like this conference. And I'll be talking more about that when we get to the revivals and how interdenominational, non-denominational it was. It was preaching the gospel. And the adequate number of chaplains to serve in all the Virginia regiments never materialized, as was the case for the chaplains from all the other states and regiments from other states. Even with the denominations behind them at every level, the chaplains faced a lot of obstacles, and they faced a lot of indecision by the Confederate government. The Reverend T.V. Moore, pastor of the Second Presbyterian Church of Richmond, told his congregation that, quote, the government's action towards chaplains was wrong, suicidal, short-sighted, and should be remedied. So there were problems these men had to face. I don't want to make it sound like a man wanted to become a chaplain, so he went down to the local recruiting office and signed up. It wasn't that at all. Most chaplains were appointed by their colonels, and then it had to be approved. And in the Confederate legislature, well, according to the Richmond Inquirer, the states, the individual states, had promised potential chaplains a pay equal to that of a captain. It was $140 a month. But the law of May 3rd, 1861, in the Confederate Congress, set their monthly pay at $85. And a bunch of other congressmen brought that under attack and reduced it 2 weeks later to $50 a month. So now they're getting down towards the privates. Don't think that the Confederate Congress represented the second coming of the 12 apostles. Most of the men in the Confederate Congress were professional politicians who had made their living and had grown up in Washington, D.C. They were now in Richmond. They had transferred their loyalty and their location. But these guys, a lot of them, were insider politicos. Some of them were drunks. Others, of course, had alley cat ethics, not unlike some today. And most Confederate congressmen were no friends of chaplains in the chaplaincy. And so they had to overcome legislators, primarily, but they also had to overcome officers, especially regimental commanders, colonels, who were irreligious, perhaps anti-Christian, saw no need for preachers in any capacity except maybe to shoot a rifle and be cannon fodder with the rest of the men. And so there was prejudice to overcome, both political and among the Army itself. Congressman Wiley P. Harris of Mississippi moved to reduce chaplain salaries to $40, quote, since they only preach once a week and had the rest of the time free. Where do you hear the schedule that these chaplains, that the best ones, kept up? That puts a lie to that comment. The major Protestant denominations sought to overcome the financial handicaps by supplementing the government salary. Under Moses Hogue's persuasion, by 1864, 80% of the Presbyterian chaplains received partial or entire support from their denomination. The government wasn't going to take care of them, the church was. And so Presbyterians were probably the first to step up as an organized denomination to provide for their chaplains. According to one Baptist publication, some regiments themselves helped pay their chaplain's salary in order to retain his services. Can you imagine in today's Army being all that they can be? Doing something like that? Another revision of the law referring to Parsons and Gray in August 61 said virtually relegated the chaplains to the status of private by providing that he was to receive one ration per day, same as a private. A number of chaplains resigned their commissions, allegedly as a result of that August act. The lack of provisions provided by law, a salary which created difficulties in supporting his family, and other discriminatory practices which denigrated their status as officers, were combined with a lack of regulations conferring rank and uniform. Congress refused to deal with that. So the chaplains never received an official rank. In the old Army, they would receive the rank and pay of captain and later major. But here, every proposal brought before Congress conferring rank on the chaplains was killed by the Military Affairs Committee. The Confederate Congress, in the end, denied the chaplains the pride and prestige associated with official Army rank, although the chaplains were de facto treated with respect and honor in the Army itself, and were most often attached to the regimental staff. Confederate Congress also ignored the issue of uniforms. We don't need to go into that. Chaplains pretty much designed their own uniforms, and we have some wonderful photographs of chaplains in uniform, typically a long black frock coat, and they developed their own insignia that they used. But there were differences. The Chaplains Association of the Army of Northern Virginia, most of them Virginians, adopted a device consisting of, quote, a ring of gold 3/4 inch in diameter and 1/18 breadth, enclosing an open Bible of silver, the device upon black cloth to be worn on lapel or collar. It's really the only insignia that the Confederate chaplains acquired that we know of. Well, the real test for the effectiveness of chaplains, of course, was on the field of combat. And I'm going to talk about the ministry of the men tomorrow night, but let me close by just to tell you what manner of men these were, to tell you about a few of the chaplains who really gave their all in many different ways, but on the field of combat. Back to Bishop, later to become Bishop J.C. Granberry, the man who was somewhat pacifistic in his leanings. He said at one point that preachers should preach, not lead troops. But at the Battle of Malvern Hill, who was in the front line, in the battle line, in the line of battle, with the troops, no weapons, just his Bible, Chaplain Granberry. And at Malvern Hill, he was left for dead on the field. He was wounded, I don't know, he was hit 5 or 6 times at Malvern Hill while he was ministering to wounded men on the battle line. He was left for dead there. It says he was badly wounded and left on the field for dead, but recovered, losing the sight of an eye from the effects of the wound in his head. Chaplain Granberry, he was out for a couple months recovering, and then he was back in, and he served until Appomattox. And he was a terrific chaplain, a wonderful preacher, an evangelical Episcopalian chaplain. But he was shot down early in the war, and he bounced back. You can imagine what kind of ministry and respect the men that he had with his men. Chaplain John Deans of the 61st Virginia drowned crossing a rain-swollen Potomac during a retreat. Post-chaplain Frank Stanley died at a Danville hospital of paralysis. So chaplains suffered the same vicissitudes as the men did, and they died too. An unknown number of Virginia chaplains took up rifles and joined the fray. Chaplain E.J. Willis, Thomas Nelson Conrad, J. Tyler Frazier, and Abner Hopkins were all known in their respective regiments as fighting parsons. A.C. Hopkins, that rugged Presbyterian from Martinsville, was cited for gallantry at the Battle of Mine Run. He was in the line of battle, every battle. A.C. Hopkins was there with his gun, firing away. One Virginia chaplain got carried away in the role of unit commander after all the officers in the company had been killed, and he took command of the company and led them throughout the battle. A number of the chaplains came to the position of the chaplaincy by starting out in the ranks and earning the respect of the men and then moving up as chaplains. E.J. Willis, who I mentioned earlier, raised a company of the 45th Virginia and distinguished himself on many a bloody field before becoming a chaplain. In fact, he commanded his regiment at Sharpsburg. He took the colors, wrapped them around his sword, and led the charge. And I could go on and on with accounts of these various men. Someone mentioned earlier Randolph McKim. He was a soldier. He was in the ranks, and he was Randolph Harrison McKim, and he left the Army to go to seminary in the middle of the war. And as soon as he got his training, came right back in as a chaplain and served very well in the 2nd Virginia Cavalry. Some of the chaplains were colorful figures, and I don't have time to relate some of those. Let me tell you just one. Another chaplain from the Old Dominion volunteered regularly for scouting missions into Maryland and Washington, D.C., disguised as a farmer, and often as a Yankee chaplain. Beautiful. Espionage suited the Reverend Carson from the very beginning of the war, for he was clapped in irons in 1861 and thrown in Old Capitol Prison for, quote, communicating with the enemy and sending recruits to the Confederate Army. As a confidant of John Surratt, this Methodist chaplain was again arrested and almost lynched in April 1865 after the assassination of President Lincoln. So he kept... He had federal chaplain uniforms that he would don and go behind enemy lines. Well, there are other accounts of chaplains who fought in the ranks, chaplains who stood on the line of battle and were killed in action. And I want to close with just a quote from a recent book, A Mississippi Rebel in the Army of Northern Virginia, by a private David Holt, who records, I think, in excellent summary fashion, a foot soldier's attitude towards a chaplain. Now, the soldier writing this is a dyed-in-the-wool Episcopalian, and his chaplain was a dyed-in-the-wool primitive Baptist. Oil and water. But hear what he has to say. Sometimes the preacher would be our own chaplain, Brother Lomax, a stubborn old hard-shell Baptist. What other kind are there? Ignorant and prejudiced and narrow in his religious ideas. But all the men loved and respected him, thus showing that a man is often better than his religion. When a fight came off, Brother Lomax would fill his canteens with water and his pockets with tourniquets and bandages and go with the line of battle. Often he would be the first man to reach the man who fell wounded or killed. If killed, Brother Lomax noted who he was and said a prayer commending his soul to God. If wounded, he rendered first aid and spoke comforting words, telling of God's love and the forgiveness of sin and how courage was one of his gifts. And that God was our Father who wanted us to have enough confidence in him to ask him for those things necessary for us. He seemed to be without personal fear and only intent upon relieving the men in distress. The religious peculiarities of such a chaplain cut no figure because we all stood on the basis of Christianity. Our Lord has laid down the law that determines the judgment of men. By their works shall ye know them. I was the warm friend of Brother Lomax and always went to hear him preach. And I think that man kind of sums up the attitude that you find over and over and over again toward Confederate chaplains in general, Virginia chaplains in particular, especially right up until the end of the war.